In this episode, I'm in conversation with Ewan Winton. Hello and welcome to another episode of the QI Guy in conversation with. I'm going to keep this brief because I had a great but lengthy conversation with my guest this episode, Ewan Winton, who is an assistant professor of design at Heriot Watt University. We spoke about all things design, some tips on how you can start your design journey, what design means, and how design can help us address some of the challenges that we have in healthcare, and how it might be different or might enhance some of the change management methods that we're already using. So, yep, a lengthy one might take you a couple of sittings to get through, or an extra long car journey. But without further ado, here's my conversation with Ewan. Right, welcome back to the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Ewan Winton, who is an associate professor of design.
I'm an assistant professor of design.
Assistant professor.
Working towards an associate.
Who knew there were so many different levels? They seem to give away professorships at Hogwarts quite easily, but you have to work through. So, welcome and thanks for joining me, Ewan. I'm really excited about this because, again, it's another conversation, kind of certainly out with my comfort zone, but I'm sure kind of it'll be new territory to a lot of people that are listening, because it's design, you know, what is design? But before we jump into that, I wonder if you want to maybe tell us a wee bit about your background and kind of your journey into the design world, and how you came to be an assistant professor of design.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me on, Jonathan. I guess it all kicked off as soon as I left school. The first thing I realised was I wasn't ready for university. And I had always been quite creative at school. Typically, the only form of design I thought about, being more from a kind of visual side, was graphic design, and instantly I thought, right, that's what I'm going to go and do, but I'm going to get a job. I'm going to find some way into industry that way. And only later on did I kind of find passion for other aspects of design. But when I left, I got an apprenticeship, and strangely, it was at Heriot Watt, where I'm back now as an assistant prof. But I started here on a traineeship, where I engaged with all sorts of things, from television to print design to internet to sound, lighting, a whole host of things. And all of those things I've touched on throughout my career. But being quite young, I finished that programme, which was a 3-year programme, and I'd picked up skills quite quickly in the area of kind of internet and digital media. This would have been I kicked off in this area about 95, so things were progressing quickly, you know. Audience numbers were doubling weekly, and we're just growing exponentially, and we were in that position of, oh right, and I'm learning this stuff going on with it. So fast forward a couple of years, I spent a bit more time there, was involved in large research networks and internet systems and digital support systems, and ended up with shingles, and thought, this is a time to reevaluate what's going on. I had shingles in my eye, almost lost sight in my right eye. Thought, what, 22 years old or something? I thought, let's see what else is out there. And ended up going to Napier University or Edinburgh Napier as it is now, as a software specialist. But very quickly got drawn into three-dimensional design, and ended up doing my degree, my master's, my postgraduate certificate in education, all of which I was doing studying and working full-time. And in What I developed was in 3D design and interdisciplinary practices along with design futures. So 3D, thinking about objects and how we use them. Interdisciplinary design, continuing that idea, but looking at service design as well and change making. And then design futures was looking at kind of what technologies, what tools, what resources are required for future developments. So always looking at the progressive nature of design. After almost 20 years at Napier, I finished with a PhD at Lancaster University, and that was in co-design, but it focused on design working with people living with dementia. And throughout my progression, I've been working on various research projects, at the centre of which I place co-design or collaboration as being key. And what that means is opening up opportunities to people to get involved in design activities in a way that's relevant to them. So I think it's really key to some of the areas that you're touching on, that designers aren't necessarily how the classic architect might have been looked upon.
Right.
Someone sending down information to be utilized, because all knowing fully engaged in processes. It's design has changed massively in that sense. It's saying to people who are specialists, how do we engage? And that's how I've started to develop my work.
Yeah. So there's a couple of terms there that I kind of picked up, because I think design is fairly new within the kind of health and social care space in terms of how we kind of change and bring about change. But you mentioned service design. So certainly here in Scotland, within kind of the NHS, I work with a service designer, and I've come across service designers. And you'd also mentioned co-design, which is another term that will be familiar to health staff and the co-design work around dementia services will be familiar to some others. But, you know, if you had to kind of define what design means, like, you know, in a simple sentence or two, you know, how would you do that? And, you know, is service design and co-design, is that kind of unique branches of that bigger definition, or how is that different?
One of the big things you'll have come across, everyone designs, and actually that's completely true. We organise and structure things to make our lives better. Design has a habit of looking at trends and patterns and trying to pull that information in a way that creates tools or systems or products that help to make people's lives better. That's a central thing. Design should improve, and really at the end of the day, design is separated at the moment between kind of consumerist behaviour and various other areas, but ultimately the hope to change for good. And that's the area of design I'm interested in. But it's so historically a design was a solution drawn and put into production. Now it may be a number of routes to getting ideas, to shaping those ideas and producing something that will improve scenarios and situations. And hence why design can be applied in numerous ways, which is why every company in the world is selling design thinking and saying, this is a solution for all business and for all issues, because at the end of the day, it's a mindset and a series of tools.
And you'd mentioned there that mindset is maybe about putting more emphasis on kind of not just necessarily putting the end user at the centre, because we'd often talk about that in healthcare if we're looking at change methodologies, QI methodologies, whatever it might be, or put the patient at the centre. But design is kind of almost kind of saying, oh, actually bring them along, you know, is it kind of integrating them more rather than just think about them, but actually how do you incorporate them into how you meant design that project. Is that right? Is that, I'm picking that
For
up
me,
right?
that's where good co-design happens. And
Right.
actually, yes, you might well be saying that's where good design happens. I've been working on a paper with Professor Paul Rogers from Strathclyde recently, which was looking at different forms of co-design. Because there's some that are still at the very beginning, we'll talk to users and then we'll understand what they said and make change. Then there's the kind of position where you're doing work, you're spending a bit more time with people, but ultimately you're coming up with the solutions, through to an evolution where actually it's not uncommon for me to stand back and go, what have I actually done here? The group have done it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a hugely powerful thing to facilitate people in identifying and feeling like they've got the power to inform change is massive. It's all too easy to have conversations with people of, oh, we've been down this before, nothing ever changes, it all stays the same. Well, if you actually, through a process of bringing people along with you, keep them embedded in the process along, all the way along, they become project champions, they become testers, they become people who generate new ideas and evolution, they generate a solution worth having, and then they go out and market to a degree because they're saying to the people that they work with, this is brilliant, we've done this, we think it's really going to help you, you should get involved. And that way, it is about this social learning, it's about being creative together.
I don't know. I think we maybe do that in health and social care in pockets, but I think you know, certainly my experience of co-design in health and social care is probably that first definition of let's talk to some people at the start and find out what they need, and then we'll go away and make changes, and actually you're not guaranteed that the changes that you make are then not influenced by that system and don't actually then reflect what you've heard back. So that kind of approach to where you're bringing those folk along, and like you say, whether it's the staff you're working with or whether it's, you know, maybe patients or families, you probably would want to be in that space where you're kind of stepping back and think, I've not actually done anything here. There's pockets of that, there's examples of that. Some of the methodologies that folk will be familiar with in healthcare in terms of design and change will be quite diagnostic almost and their kind of approach in the tools. So I'm thinking like QI, there's lots of tools that we use to kind of diagnose the problem, and there'll be some kind of dialogic tools to kind of open up that conversation as well. You know, how is design applied in real life? Like, how would you design apply kind of tools? What tools are you using to a project like that where you can bring patients along, and how are you kind of diagnosing that problem and visualizing it? Is that different from what, you know, we use things like fishbone diagrams and process maps and things that feel very kind of, you know, almost medical in this context? Are you guys, how are you doing that in design? Is that done in a different way?
Not always, but sometimes. I think it's always the, or yeah, every design system or approach should be tailored to fit the scenario and group and possibilities of a project. I'm trying to remember now, it's not behind me on my shelves, a book by, I think the person's surname is Metrovarsky, who talks about the designer's toolkit as being a bit like the ingredients a chef has. The various methods they have or methodologies they have in preparing a meal. You can say, well, this will suit beautifully with that, and we need to pull that in, and how do we get that extra bit of something? So and usually, because of a project, you'll have multiple kinds of stakeholders. So you'll have people who will really just want to know statistical content, you know. How many of these can we save? How much money can we save? Then you've got the qualitative approach, where it's about what's the experience like? What does that experience do to improve situations? And then where can design interventions happen? So we do a lot of prototyping, testing, creating little tools and devices for understanding the problem more. So to quote Paul again, he'll often talk about it's a good design research question will probably just result in more questions. At some point, you've got to kind of say, right, we're pulling all this together, and how do we navigate that? But we'll use everything from camera journaling to a day in the life to ethnographic, sort of rapid ethnographic approaches of observation, and then we'll do questioning of scenarios. We will create maps and hands-on kits for creative conversations. I think there's nothing better than a creative conversation, because if you look at a situation and say it's a list of questions and you answer those, you're not really getting to the heart of something, because a lot of knowledge that we have, we don't realise we have. It's when you start doing a task or playing through a role that you go, oh, yeah. And sometimes I'll do this, or it would be so much easier if I could do that. But it's only by bringing in those scenario models that you start to unpick things. So as I say, we are programmed to use multiple approaches as designers, and that's just part of our training. We pick things up along the way. Having said that, you know, the likes of IDEO, they do a lot of online accessible training courses and tools for you. I think IDEOU.com. That's IDEO. for those who don't know IDEO.
We could put the link in the show notes for folk to access.
But they do a lot of working through the design research methods that most designers will use. And it's then about choosing which ones of those to cobble together. And then obviously budget and time constraints and people's availabilities. And it's a very open question, that one.
You know, and the reason I ask that is because I do think that kind of improvers within healthcare have their tools and their toolkit that they use, and like I said, it can be quite diagnostic and quite boring, shall I say, if that's the word, in a kind of general sense. But I also think within health and social care there is a bit of potential resistance if you bring something that doesn't fit that. So when you're talking about some things there, like kind of camera journaling or that more those more creative outputs that you might do, and you and I are obviously doing a bit of work together at the minute, and I've seen firsthand when we did a workshop, and people were drawing, people were using kind of visual tools that you had drawn up to kind of mark where they worked in a specific area and who they worked with. They were being photographed, and they were also doing the traditional here's five questions, give us your kind of thoughts. And I know that that's been received really well, but what kind of do you see resistance to some of these design outputs when you're using that kind of broad creative thing? Do you see anybody maybe challenging the validity of you're showing me something based on some pictures you took versus there's maybe something that's deemed more scientific, if you like, from a diagnostic type exercise? Do you see any kind of resistance to that? How do you kind of combat that?
I would always say it's any problem, you're going to have multiple layered conversations of whatever form. And what you were just talking about, great example. We can't be in operating theatres without a hell of a lot of paperwork and vetting and all sorts of stuff. And it would probably take about 3 or 4 years for us to even get close to being able to do that. Whereas we can speak to people who have fairly time-intensive restrictions, and we need to get access to information that we as outsiders can't access and can't understand, and can't understand relationships. We've been told by people who will turn around and say, there's communication problems. Okay, well, why do those communication problems exist? Which is a good example of where some of the tools we generated started from. And it was trying to understand who's speaking to whom, who's moving around where. And by mapping those things quite quickly, giving people very simple tasks to do, they actually became more engaged, I think, than you would have got just from sitting in a room.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, what you'll get sitting in a room is the loudest voice talking.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we can invite 40 people, and some will turn around and say, oh, I'm not doing that, can I draw?
Yeah.
we can all draw. We might not be Michelangelo, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
All you need to do is communicate where possibilities are or where problems lie. So you can put a dotted line in, you can circle something, you can, one of the examples we've got is how people were identifying the specialties they work in. And,
yeah.
And some of those are quite, you know, they're almost like the icons you would find on Snapchat or something like that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Brilliant. Because actually that's the visual language that people talk in. So there's layers to all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could design an all-singing, over-the-top solution, but actually, if the most common thing is an emoji and mm-hmm. people get the emoji straight away, then why redesign it? That is a language that people understand. So once you start to pick these things apart, you can actually demonstrate to people there's much more complexity there, but also that it shoehorns or fits almost like jigsaw pieces with their perceptions and understanding. But we're able to open up different things. And that's why there's always the ability to push back and argue for the value in what's being done through these kind of practices.
Yeah, and I certainly, having worked with kind of service designers and yourselves and always and seeing how some of these tools can work, I think it is that kind of blended approach, like you said, it's that kind of layered approach. And it probably is about, you know, the old horses for courses thing, like, what do you need to know and what's the best way to get it? And certainly I'm being opened up to more that that visual mapping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's kind of get a visual map of how some of these interactions are actually playing out, rather than maybe using, you know, in more three dimensions, rather than using a kind of flat two-dimensional, okay, we've got some kind of tool based in engineering that allowed them to identify problems in a production line, and we're going to use that about a very, you know, especially in health and social care, a very complex operation that's hugely variable from, you know, in healthcare, one case to the next could be hugely variable, let alone one day to the other. So how do those interactions play out? And like you said, actually, yeah, we know that communication's a problem, but how is it a problem? And this kind of design approach and that more creative approach is really opening up my eyes to the possibility of how we can explore the problems. And I think that's where I see design being really, really helpful, is actually being able to truly articulate what the problem is,
mm-hmm.
first and foremost.
When you were talking about mapping there, instantly and things that sprung to mind, is you'll get a mapping of a process. Dependent on how you let people map, you might find that something that you find quite small and insignificant becomes a big thing on that map.
Mm-hmm.
And that big thing is because that's a big stumbling block for whoever who is working in that scenario on a daily basis, or someone who finds that as a problematic key point. So you might go along this map going, yeah, we understand, that's just a wee thing. But when you get people given you their visualization of it, suddenly you can see, oh wow, there's a bit of a pattern here, or there's an anomaly. What is that anomaly, and can we drill into it?
Yeah.
So exactly what you're saying, you know, can we identify the things? And more often than not, what we're trying to do is finesse, especially in systems design, finesse the bits that aren't right in order to support the things that are right.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Absolutely. I was it's probably ham-fisted because I'm not a trained designer. Not yet. I'm just starting a qualification in design, actually. But we were down in a clinic yesterday where, again, they're looking at how they can improve the capacity and do more throughput through the clinic. And myself and my colleague went down and we mapped the patient journey. We had the floor plans and we stood at the entryway and say, right, your patient walks up here and then the first touch point is there and then they go here. And then we spoke to kind of staff. So we've kind of come up with that kind of visual spaghetti, you know, of all those touch points and how it happens. And you can see straight away, probably in a much more visual and a much more immediate way than if you did a process map, that actually there's 7 or 8 touch points for, oh, the patient comes in and they see the nurse and the consultant. That's what the folk would tell you. But actually the patient comes in, they go to reception, they go to the waiting area, they go here, they go back to the waiting area, they go there, they go back to the waiting area, they go here. You know, and also then that looks different depending on the day of the week. So actually, if it's a Monday morning, or they don't go here, they go there. You know, and like you said, Ewan, those things in a conversation in a room might not feel significant, but when you start to map that out, all of a sudden we're like, okay, this little journey that people don't think is a problem, if they're doing that 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day, that's adding up to, you know, a huge inefficiency in terms of time spent moving and traveling, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
so it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's so funny because a good design approach will allow people to hack the systems and hack what's going on and then tell you why they've hacked them. And those hacks are what they do on a daily basis to navigate what's not right. So that allows you to kind of go, well, right. So rather than the solution just being worked around or the existing issue being worked around, it gives people the platform to suggest why and how to improve and make changes. And it is it's an incredibly powerful thing. I'm really interested in what you were saying as well about kind of mapping those journeys and going through the processes, because we're talking about that at quite a low-fi level at the moment, but those things can make significant interventions further down the line. I've not done much in the way of follow-up investigation on it for quite a while, but I'm sure it was in Bath, the hospital that was built there must be about 7 or 8 years ago, was designed to be like a boutique hotel. And there was even a spare bed in the rooms for patients, loved ones to stay in the room with them and all that stuff. And it was designed, I think it was the Foster's Partners that designed it. And one of the key things, as soon as you walked through the door, you smelt the coffee shop that was there. It was kind of making you feel much more at one. All the kind of usual NHS signage was done away with, because almost that stuff would happen back of house, but front of house, you didn't need that. And what they discovered was and where they've done this elsewhere, it shortened the period of time people were in hospital, because they were actually feeling, or the perception was they were feeling more relaxed, were recovering quicker, got out sooner. So these kind of mapping those zones of influence, the journeys required, the experience of being there, led to this massive multi-million, probably billion-pound development that initially you might go, well, that's a bit frivolous, is it not? But if it means people are out of the system quicker and happier and more complete in their recuperation, then actually it's got massive knock-on effects.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what it's all about, particularly in health and social care, is as resources become more constrained, it's about maximising how we use those to, you know, enhance people's experience and get them in and out of the hospitals in particular, which is really interesting, because there's often a lot of focus, you know, obviously on keeping people at home and in a homely environment. Why can't our hospitals be a homely environment, you know? Because some people, that's the only place they can be treated, depending on what's up with them. So, yeah, and I think design maybe brings the mindset to then challenge what we think a traditional hospital should be like, or the issues that we have to be thinking about in a traditional hospital. And myself and my colleague, when we were doing some of that mapping yesterday, as you said, it was low-fly. Straight away, we were identifying some of those, like, decisions had been made based on conventional thinking within a hospital, but actually that mapping and that visualisation, we are now able to challenge some of that.
Absolutely.
Whereas I think beforehand, we would have just expected what the experts told us, no, this needs to happen because of this issue or that issue. So you mentioned at the start of the chat, Ewan, about the kind of, you know, the hope of making things better. So, I mean, do you see design having a specific role within health and social care? Is there something that design can help us maybe tackle a kind of above and beyond any other priorities or any other kind of methodologies that were kind of, you know, challenges that we're wrestling with in health and social care in 2023 and beyond?
Yeah, well, it's one of those classic scenarios. As designers, we have to kind of flagellate ourselves and blame ourselves for mass production, mass consumption, mass waste. But having been part of that process, it's our duty now to help streamline, improve, reduce waste, think about our position of impacting global health, not just human health. And I think we have a great opportunity to work with numerous parties within the NHS and in small scenarios to much larger situations, which is why we are part of research initiatives with yourself. Mm-hmm. And that is identifying where issues lie. But this is where the importance of people come in. Mm-hmm. So the work we are doing currently, we're also looking at the quality of the goods and services that people are engaging with. And in this case, it's your staff. And what we're looking at is making sure comfort and fit and appropriateness of material choices and usability of resources comes to the forefront. So it's about improving on existing situations, reducing landfill, making your staff feel prioritised, and ensuring that the products they're working with are the best they can possibly be. So as you can imagine from that, that's a consistent consideration for multiple areas, I think, within NHS. And Golden Jubilee is great because they've got our experience with you guys at Golden Jubilee has been great because you've got a progressive mindset. There will always be gatekeeping. Mm-hmm. No matter what. I did my PhD in dementia, and the amount of gatekeeping there was incredible. And that even goes down to loved ones of participants. Mm-hmm. So participants showing a willingness and a real desire to be involved in something, but then loved ones maybe holding them back because they're not sure if it's a bit new, a bit different. Once we get past these barriers and show, some people need to see the change. Some mm-hmm. people need to kind of understand that what is written are merely codes or rules based on the best knowledge at the time that they were written. Yeah. And at the time, things like disposable items were seen as great because they minimized certain issues, but then they've maximized global consumption. So, you know, there's trade-offs. So that's one side. For me, the quality of experience is always key. As I was saying with my work with working with people with dementia, I've also done work with people who have Down syndrome and learning development issues to work on public arts projects. But what those were really initiatives for were discussing death with groups of people who were usually circumnavigated and not brought into conversation. And there's a short film coming out. We're hoping to have that coming out in a couple of months. I think it's first going to be aired at the Scottish Parliament. So it's looking at how important those lived experiences for people can be. And I think that's key all the way through, is making sure people feel valued, feel respected, and feel part of the solution.
I think there's so many things you said that is key through this conversation, you and about the kind of mindset and bringing people with you, and I think the creative nature of design, because I think, you know, you're touching on issues there that obviously tie into climate change and health and social care's contribution to that, is that we are going to have to see a kind of paradigm shift in mindset or in what we do and how we do it in order to make ourselves more sustainable. And I think design with other kind of methods and approaches can maybe help challenge some of that. But you're absolutely right. The healthcare we love a rule. We love a hierarchy, and in some instances that's great, because that can help provide assurances around perhaps who's doing surgery on you and cutting into you and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But in terms of this innovation and actually finding creative solutions and different solutions to some of our problems, it can sometimes be a bit of a barrier. But it feels to me like certainly the work that we've done so far and the way that we've approached that is that it's allowed us to have the conversation in a different way. With people, which has actually, I think, contributed a huge part to getting over some of that, you know, gatekeeping or some of that resistance that you might find within certain quarters, because actually we're able to visualize and share in a different way that this isn't as big an issue as you think, you know, or thinking has moved on, or actually we've got a role in terms of actually evolving the next thought and establishing the next rule, within health and social care, the next way of doing things. So it's really fascinating. So I'd mentioned that last week was my first session. I'm starting a PDA in service design.
Okay.
And I kind of through a journey there and kind of get more exposure to the kind of methods and the tools and the kind of thinking and approach to that. But where would you recommend people go? Where would you sign those folk to go and start to maybe learn more about design and service design approaches if they're listening to this and they don't know anything or even just a wee bit? Where would you suggest they maybe invest their time?
As I said, the IDEO are a great starting point. There's some great books I've got. Someone my desk here, but there's a book called Creative Conscience, which is by the Kellys, who were the two brothers who set up IDEO. And for those of you who don't know who IDEO are, they're one of the big, largest global players in design thinking and design practice. But interestingly, they've turned into an educational establishment. And they provide short course training and resources and toolkits and all sorts of stuff. Some of the stuff they do charge you for, but some stuff is free, so it's worth having a look there.
Mm-hmm.
I've completely gone blank now. And I was thinking about it before. What I would suggest I'll do is share some of the links and information with you,
so that'd be great.
You can put those out there. But Scotland's got governmental position called Scotland's Approach to Service Design. I'm not entirely sure how different it is to service design or good design, but ultimately, you know, there's resources there and they're worth tapping into. So the Scottish Government website will have them. The other thing, and I meant to talk about this earlier, and this is where it will really throw those of the wrong of a mindset that's different, is play. So absolutely. We talk a lot about playful design and play in design. And what that really is about is breaking down barriers and overcoming obstructions to more open-minded thinking. And one of the there's been a lot of writing recently about playful design, design and play, play in design. And that's really saying, actually, quite a lot of the time, games have rules and you have to work around those rules, but also play allows us to think openly and effectively. And as kids we learn by playing. They often say that education, and I shouldn't say this too loudly seeing I work at a university, but education designs creativity out of us. Think about your high school experience. You're kind of told to stop dreaming and stop thinking about things in those ways, and then the first thing I do is say start dreaming, start thinking about things in new ways. So I would I will look out some of the connections that have got there around playful design and
I'm sure there'll be some people who are listening to this who are familiar with the Lego series play. And I do know there's some folk within healthcare who become trained in that and use that, and it's about what that playing unlocks. It's not necessarily about we're going to sit and play with Lego or we're going to sit and play this game, but it's the, you know, almost back to what you were kind of describing with the art projects with people with learning disabilities or certain conditions. It's less about that, but it's about what it allows you to do through that. You know, whether it's having those conversations, or in this case, it might be unlocking that creativity and helping to guide people into that different space where they can be creative about your problem and your thing.
Lego's a great way of thinking about systems. One of my former students when I was at Napier, was one of the product design students, ended up working at Lego, and when I was speaking to him, he said, you know, one of his first things was they visited a police station and they had to try to figure out how they would break out of that police station, and then they designed a Lego set around it. So they said you'll find that there's a little spanner that goes in a box under the bed. That's all part of the narrative for getting out of this place, and there's little hidden tricks and tips and stuff, and that it's exactly that mindset. As a kid, you would be coming up with those ideas and solutions. But equally, and the serious play stuff's brilliant, so I would say have a look at what Lego are doing. The other thing that Lego has done, I just saw it announced today somewhere, is created a play to learn Braille using Lego.
Wow.
So the dots on the Lego blocks are designed as Braille touch points, which I thought was an interesting way of rethinking the materials. And again, what Lego are doing in trying to get around what they have been perceived as a plastic product, they're now looking at new materials that they can use to improve their service. So, yeah, I mean, all of that, what you will find is there's constant innovation going on, and just being aware that these massive companies are doing these things, not because they're frivolous or childish, because they unlock something.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think education, formal education, certainly in your younger years, perhaps knocks some of that out of you. So absolutely, we need to be bringing that back and engaging both sides of the brain. I'm sure some hippie would tell you, switch on their side of your brain. Definitely. Well, Ewan, thank you. We'll put some of the links to the different kind of resources and different places in the show notes. But thank you very much for your time today. I think that's been a hugely helpful conversation, and it's hopefully inspired some folk to learn a wee bit more about design and how it could help them within health and social care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Ewan for taking the time out to have a chat with me and discuss all things design. Hopefully again it's inspired you to maybe look a wee bit further into a new topic or a new area. We spoke about IDEO as a great organisation to perhaps go and start your design journey, and you will find the links to IDEO in the show notes. So, as always, thanks for listening. Make sure you're following us on the socials. It's now X rather than Twitter. I wonder how that's been evaluated. But make sure you follow us at @QI_guy. And please remember to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, take care.